West, and many other leaders of the labor movement and the social justice movement. And I would say of faith-based groups, because I identify, full disclosure, as a Dorothy Day Catholic. That's who I am. And so what's happened is that we're seeing, and the 9/11 response of the first responders and the broader community, the faith community, the labor movement, is why there's a World Trade Center health program, right? That's something that we accomplished and even got reactionary Republicans to join in bipartisan support. So at least those brave souls that responded to help rebuild Lower Manhattan have health care. That is the result of the kind of organizing I'm talking about. Similarly, we see Reverend Barber making the connection between the need for us to embrace the low-wage, low-wealth workforce that has been closed out of politics as a continuation of the discrimination of Jim Crow, and that the labor movement, as certain portions of it did, needs to identify strongly with Reverend Barber's movement, the Poor People's Campaign, as elements of it did during Martin Luther King's era. Because the redemption of America's promise is embedded in keeping those promises. And so I see a multifaceted movement rooted where we live by establishing conversations we haven't had before, by being brave enough to see the history that's distorted by what happened to the Native American people through the doctrine of Christian discovery and the legacy of slavery, owning those original sins, and at the same time, building a new covenant in the workplace that puts workers first and the public interest.
Do you think we can get unstuck as a nation?
I remain optimistic, because one of the things is that every day as a reporter, the definition of news is that I go out each day and get educated by the workforce. And so I think part of the problem is the people in my business act as if we've seen it all. And so we are oblivious to change around us. Everywhere I look, I do see the collective consciousness growing. And I would say that part of it is the challenge of meeting this public health crisis, because America now is faced with an existential choice, the concept of the collective, the concept of public health, the concept of abundance and unconditional love revealed through scripture in my world, and then the selfish choice that is abundant, the one of that it's scarcity and we're out for ourselves and who, no one's going to tell me to do anything.
Bob, I can see the influence of Dorothy Day in your speech and in what you say. Thank you very much for your time and for giving us the benefit of what you learn as a first-class reporter. And to all of you watching and listening, this is a special privilege. I hope to have Bob back. And a reminder, take a look at Stuck Nation. I think you'll be glad you did. And I look forward, as always, to speaking with you again next week.
The previous program was Economic Update with Richard Wolf, heard Wednesdays at 6:30 p.m. right after the WBAI Evening News. It is now 7 p.m. Stay tuned for Off the Hook, and that's coming up.
Hello. You're listening to WBAI in New York. It's 7 o'clock. Time for Off the Hook.
The telephone keeps ringing, so I ripped it off the wall. I cut myself while shaving, now I can't make a call. We couldn't get much worse, but if they could, they would. I'm really bound for the best.
And a very good evening to everybody. The program is Off the Hook. Emmanuel Goldstein here with you on this Wednesday evening, joined tonight by Kyle.
over here.
And over in Skype land, we have Rob T. Firefly.
Good evening.
And over in the alternative Skype land, we have Alex.
Good evening, everyone.
Well, you know, the transition, the beginning of the show, that's always the most challenging part of the entire program. And so we're kind of celebrating already because we did that successfully, and it's cool. It's neat, and it's miraculous that we're all here, all on WBAI, sharing all kinds of information. And we're going to get right to the show in a moment, but I just want to emphasize to folks that WBAI is a non-commercial radio station. What that means is we don't have commercial. Did I really have to say that? We don't have commercials. We're non-commercial radio stations. Kind of obvious. But we still, that doesn't mean we don't have to pay bills. They still send us the bills, even though we don't have commercials. Imagine that. And we have to pay them somehow. And that money has to come from somewhere. You folks are the somewhere. You have been the somewhere since 1960. And we need you to step up. We always need our listeners to step up. And our listeners have always stepped up. It's incredibly easy. You may have noticed over the past year or so, we haven't been interrupting nearly as much with annoying fund drives, constantly asking for pledges. So what we are asking for instead is for listeners to call and pledge whatever they can afford, become a BAI buddy. In fact, if we could see a whole bunch of BAI buddies come out of this hour, that would be great. That would be great for us. It would be great for management, who has made it clear that we need to do a little bit more here. And I agree, we do. 212-209-2950. Call that number and say, hey, say hello. I'd like to be a BAI buddy. And they'll walk you through it. What that means is you can pledge, well, I don't know, $5 a month? $5 a month? I pledge that for a bunch of kittens. Yeah, it's a kitten academy. I pledge $5 a month for them.
You could do $9.95.
So I could easily do $5 a month for BAI, and I think I definitely will. I don't know why I haven't done this already. But $5 a month, it's nothing. And it adds up over the course of a year. You could do $10 a month. You could do $50 a month. Whatever you can afford, it helps. It makes this place continue to operate. And it's not easy to operate a full-power radio station in the middle of the FM dial, in the middle of Manhattan, which is what we are doing and what we have been doing since 1960. It's a miracle. And you help make that miracle possible. You can also go to give2wbai.org, give the number 2wbai.org, and you can pledge that way as well. And be sure to say your favorite program is Off the Hook. That way people know that Off the Hook listeners are coming through as well. That is very, very important. Now, we're not going to be on next week. Next week, a special program will be on. We'll be on in 2 weeks. And we'll be continuing to ask for your support in various ways, because that's the only way we stay here. It's the only way any of this stays here. You guys want to say anything about that, Rob?
Yeah, absolutely. It's easy to forget because it's so easy to listen to the radio and listen to online streams and take in the great content that they're putting out for you. But this does cost money. Every minute we are pumping what we are doing out into those airwaves and over those networks, meters are running, basically. And the only thing that has kept the bills for those meters paid is you out there listening. Yes, since 1960, that is, 61 years of just doing this, just asking for help and getting it from our wonderful listeners. That is the only thing that has kept the lights on here at WBAI.
You would be hard-pressed to find another radio station in New York City that has been on the air doing basically the same format, which for us is many different formats, for 61 years. Every single frequency, they've gone through some kind of turmoil. They've gone through some kind of ownership change. They've gone from country to classical. You know, they've alienated their listeners in one way or another. And I know we do that too occasionally in various ways. But the basic idea of WBAI has remained the same since that first day in 1960. And this station, by the way, this station, the frequency, 99.5 FM, was donated to the Pacifica Foundation. And it's not an easy thing to donate a full-power radio station in the middle of New York City and not be hung up on because people think you're just joking or just out of your mind. So after a few valiant calls, the owner of the station, the former owner of the station, was able to successfully convince somebody that, yes, in fact, I have an FM radio station that I'd like to donate. And that is an incredible story, one of many incredible stories that are part of 99.5 FM in New York City.
We're making it as easy as possible with those programs, and it automates it. It takes it out of your hair and really eliminates the operational nitty-gritty and mailing and correspondence and all that stuff. You're set up. You're good for the year. You'll get reminders. You'll be really happy that your contribution is in progress, and the rest of the programmers and dedicated volunteers can focus on running the station and really getting great programming out there on the airwaves.
212-209-2950. Give to WBAI.org. Go ahead, Alex.
And I think it bears mentioning, too, that it is not a foregone conclusion that this station is always going to be around, because it has been around. I can't believe it that we're going up on almost 22 years. But I remember, and I think I remember, I mentioned this quite a bit when we talk about fundraising. But back in January of 2000, there was a coup that tried to take away the station.
No. January of 2001.
Was it 2000?
Yeah, I know this. I know this because I'm scanning my negatives, which is a fun project if you ever want to get involved in something that'll take hours of your time. I'm scanning negatives of photographs I took, and just yesterday was the day where the police came to WBAI at 120 Wall Street because we had been taken over and listeners were in the lobby protesting, and the coup people actually called the cops and had people arrested in WBAI. And of course, we happened to be on the air at that very moment, broadcasting the entire thing. And by broadcasting the entire thing, we were basically getting all kinds of listeners to come to the station because they heard what was going on. But the funny thing is, I took a picture of a no parking sign, you know, one of those temporary ones because of some kind of production. And they made the same mistake you did. They said January 23rd, 00, because you know how it is in January, you forget to write the new year. Well, whoever filled out that no parking thing also did the same thing. So that picture is very confusing. I thought it was 2002, but it actually is 2001.
Oh, my goodness. Well, even more to the point then. I mean, we're talking about literally 20 years to the day yesterday when all of this happened. I mean, literally, people.
Well, it's not the 23rd. It's the 15th. Right.
That's correct.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, the picture I took was, I think, on the 23rd. But regardless, yes.
Oh, okay. Yeah. So yeah. Regardless, I mean, I will never forget that day when I was holding up your cell phone, which was a rare thing to have back then, and the police were in the lobby, and they started announcing. The NYPD was announcing that anybody who refused to leave the lobby was going to be arrested. And so many people there refused to leave the lobby. I remember there being a woman in a wheelchair that refused to leave the lobby, and she was arrested. And when we left the station that night, it was one of those amazing evenings where we walked out, and there had to be easily 100 people outside the station, and they were beating drums. I mean, people really cared about it because it was going to be taken over. Mm-hmm. And there was a lot of organizing that happened on the back end, both in Manhattan, Brooklyn, and especially on Long Island with our friends over at the Cinema Arts Center in Huntington, Vic Skolnick and Charlotte Skye. I think Vic has passed away, if I recall correctly. But there were all these wonderful friends. And without these friends and without this support, the station would have been gone 20 years ago. And think about what New York would be like if it didn't have WBAI.
Right. I also realize it's September, it's not January, so the date was it's not exactly 20 years yet. Or actually, no, it was 20 years already in January, January of 2021.
Right, so it's 21 years,
right.
I guess.
Yeah. The coup began in December of 2000. I know because I was overseas listening to it unfold. And it's really kind of insane to think that's what happens at radio stations that matter. And okay, that was 20 years ago. You know, we had another one 2 years ago where they actually came in and kicked everybody out and locked the doors. And it was in all the newspapers that WBAI was finished, shut down. And all the TV stations were there just basically beating the drum saying that we were finished.
Any of those papers or TV stations that want to do an update? They're more than welcome to come and or contact the station, and they would love to talk about all the great things that WBAI is doing
now.
They
never did that. A lot of them never gave the update that, hey, we won the station back in court this time, because what the people engineering that particular coup did was illegal. And that's what happens. This and you know, there are many more instances of sit-ins and takeovers and things like that have happened over the years. It's messy, but in the end, democracy prevails and free speech prevails. And to help that happen, to help that continue, we always need our listeners. And that's why we ask you to call 212-209-2950 or give to WBAI.org. Become a BAI buddy. It's the most painless way to show your support, not only for Off the Hook, but for WBAI and free speech in general. Pledge whatever you can afford for each month, and it'll just automatically be deducted, and you won't have to worry about it.
When the station's strong, a lot of that dynamic activity is really in the programming, I think.
Oh, absolutely.
And I say that because people see this value. You talked about being in the center of the city, in the center of the dial. And when you have normally that dynamic, you know, change in programming and the change in format, I guess is the correct term. Usually that's like a deal or like a corporate handover, you know, cash is exchanged, whatever. As soon as it's all good, the paper's signed,
mm-hmm.
and that's it.
That's it.
You get country. You get whatever other kind of agenda. Well, when you have a community station, it runs a little differently. The oversight, I guess, or the transactional nature really isn't as much of a part of it. There's no huge opportunity for it. So those challenges, that cold business angle, has to take different forms, and it comes at the station in different ways. And a lot of times it's under the guise of very much trying to mimic the community model so that it seeps in as something that is in the interest of the station, but not actually. So in a large part, you don't see these sorts of events very often, but as listeners, you're kind of a part of the station. And when these things happen, we let you know and inform everyone and try to be as loud as possible,
mm-hmm.
so that it doesn't come to those kinds of dire moments. But it can be very scary.
I'd
never experienced it, and it was... It was an incredible change in focus. I mean, it was all hands on deck, and people really, really had to get the message out. And it was quite hostile. So the point is, these things do occur,
mm-hmm.
and people see value and want to have that change in ownership. But often the agenda itself isn't quite clear, because it's coming in under this sort of seemingly familiar guise. And we want the agenda to be about people, the audience, the dedicated volunteers and programmers that come in and do what they can, and other people in the community, community members that are listeners or that haven't even had an opportunity to be on air yet. Those kinds of things don't happen when you have a changeover in operations, or operations have to be focused on legal battles. It's crazy. That's not radio. So we like to make sure the station's strong in light of those recent historical lessons,
mm-hmm.
by appealing to you, our audience, and everyone out there that enjoys radio and enjoys our station, our program, no matter where you are. We're all over the place because of the internet and a lot of contributions just in connecting up today. So I just want to remind people that you get to set the agenda for now because of many people's valiant efforts to keep WBAI, WBAI.
212-209-2950. And you mentioned, you know, you get country sometimes. Remember when we actually did give them country on April 1st, we did a takeover, a fake takeover, where thanks to our good friend Laszlo, who works in commercial radio, made a whole big commercial radio teaser and a countdown thing. And yes, 99.5 FM is now country. That went on for a good 15 minutes and people were calling. And it was a bit of fun, but also a reminder that nothing is guaranteed. Nothing is permanent. And if we don't maintain something, it will fall apart. You know how society is going now? That could happen to BAI. It could be the same thing. So you gotta maintain it. You gotta make sure that it's supported. And I know, you know, people will always find something to disagree with, to be outraged at. I know I will. But that's not a reason not to support the place. Support the place for what you do believe in. And that way you're there to stand up against the things you don't believe in. It's as simple as that. 212-209-2950, give2wbai.org. Go ahead, Rob.
Yeah, and Kyle just touched on something which we don't talk about a lot, but it's not only giving your financial support to the station, but if you become a member of the station, you become a member of the station. And
that's
that comes with a voice in what happens. If you donate $25 or more, whether that's a one-shot donation or whether you have monthly BAI Buddy donations once they add up to $25, you are a full voting member of WBAI. You get to vote for your representatives on the local station board. You get to stand for election to the board yourself if you want. And you get a voice in how things go at this station. And so that's even more important because, yeah, this is a station that is of its community. We are not doing what some mysterious corporate boss somewhere says. We are not doing what commercial interests say we should do. We are doing what you, the listeners, say we should do via your voices on the board and via your donations. Give2wbai.org or 212-209-2950.
And, you know, as a good example of that, only a few weeks ago, I don't want to get into particulars, but there was a referendum that came up that would have rewritten the way the
community board?
Yeah, the community board.
Local station board?
Yeah, the bylines, is that the right
bylaws.
Word? Bylaws. Bylaws. I knew I was looking for it. Basically, by doing that, a lot of power would have been funneled into a very small select group of people and away from listeners, and listeners had the opportunity to vote on this. And unlike, in our dumbass political scene, listeners voted for democracy and voted for something that would preserve the stations, not just WBAI, but the stations, all five Pacifica stations, and the structure, the governance. So yes, you do have a very important say. It'll come up again, I'm sure. It matters. It really matters. I don't really think we can say any more on that. 212-209-2950. Give to WBAI.org. Please show your support. At the end of the night, we want to see a lot of people have called and become BAI buddies. And don't forget to say Off the Hook is the show you're pledging for so that we know you're out there. It really, really matters. Okay, so we want to get into the show. We will not be on next week again. But we are on overtime after this show on YouTube. So youtube.com/channel2600. You can also just click on the link at the top of the 2600.com webpage at 8 o'clock. And that way you can call us. You can listen to other things that we might have to talk about. But for the remainder of this hour, we have a few interesting stories, including, do you remember a couple of weeks ago, the subway was completely shut down. Now, okay, I should clarify because it's happened a few times. I don't mean Ida. I don't mean when Ida came in and basically turned it into a water park. No, I mean before that, when it just mysteriously, all of a sudden, the train stopped and people had no idea what was going on. People thought the system was hacked. You know, that's always the reaction. The go-to reaction is something's broken. It must have been hacked. Where was Kevin Mitnick? You know, basically anything having to do with technology, it's our fault. Okay, well, it wasn't. It wasn't. The recent power outage that disrupted half of New York City's subway system for several hours, stranded hundreds of passengers, was likely caused by someone accidentally pressing an emergency power-off button. Yeah. And, you know, I've noticed this over the years, that usually these catastrophes, these mishaps, are caused by similar amounts of human error. You know, data loss, more data loss is caused by somebody dropping a hard drive than by somebody getting into it and doing all kinds of damage. The outside investigators who were looking into the disruption, it took place on August 29th, said there was a strong possibility that the button was accidentally pressed since the plastic guard... Stay with me here. You know how these buttons look. The plastic guard designed to prevent accidental activation was missing. Oh, why don't we have a dramatic sting right now? We so, yeah, the plastic the plastic guard for the emergency off button is missing. If you have seen it or you know where it might be, please contact us. Why not? The unprecedented breakdown affected more than 80 trains, giving a black eye to a sprawling transit system that has since been hit with flooding from the remnants of Hurricane Ida. Governor Huckle ordered a full review of operation control centers across the Metropolitan Transportation Authority to identify and fix potential weaknesses. And missing plastic coverings are on the top of that list. Huckle said New Yorkers deserve absolute confidence in a fully functioning subway system, and it is our job to restore that confidence. The breakdown affected the subway system's numbered lines, plus the L train, for several hours, beginning shortly after 9 p.m. that Sunday. Interesting, the numbered lines, meaning IRT, and the L. I'm not sure why the L train was able to piggyback onto that, or why there's a power switch that will only affect numbered trains. I'm sure there's all kinds of reasons, and I'm sure listeners will write to us. And if you are one of those listeners, oth@2600.com is our email address. But restoration of service was delayed, and here's how we blame you, the public, for this. The restoration of the service was delayed because passengers on two of the stuck trains walked out onto the tracks by themselves rather than waiting for rescuers. Yeah, bad. And that resulted in a much longer delay. Now, the button was pushed after a power dip lasting several milliseconds at 8:25 p.m., and the subsequent discovery that several pieces of mechanical equipment at the New York City Transit Rail Control Center stopped functioning. Control center staff worked to get the equipment back into service. Then someone pushed the emergency button, causing all electrical equipment connected to one of the power distribution units at the center to lose power at 9:06 p.m. Power was restored by 10:30 p.m., according to the reports. Now, officials blame the loss of power on human error and the failure to restore power for 84 minutes to inadequate organizational structure and a lack of guidelines. Yeah, MTA, there you go. So that was a bit of fun. Mystery solved. Maybe don't blame hackers as quickly as you normally do, Alex?
It's amazing to me that there's a single button that can cause an outage.
Isn't that great? Isn't that amazing?
City.
There's a button like that for probably all kinds of things.
But what amazes me more about this button is that people have resisted the temptation for God knows how many years prior to this to push it. That's some serious psychological fortitude that these people have.
It's like the button in Hitchhiker's Guide that says, do not press this button.
That's right. That's exactly right. Yeah.
And if you press it, but someone came out and said, do not press this button again. I think that's the only thing that it actually did.
Such a great book.
Yeah, absolutely. We all could read that again, I think. Sticking with actual hacking, well, maybe not actual hacking, hacking in a sense, I guess. Web page hacking is hacking, I suppose. You're taking over something and changing it a bit, but you're not always using hacking techniques. You might just be using, a script or something like that. It depends on what you do with the power that you temporarily have. Well, the official website for the Texas Republican Party, texasgop.org, was hacked on Saturday in retribution for the newly enacted Heartbeat Act that bans abortions in the state after 6 weeks from conception. Archived versions of the site show that it was briefly vandalized to display several crude messages and other content mocking and criticizing the Texas Republican Party and GOP as a whole. The person or persons who defaced the website also made numerous references to Anonymous. We could use that dramatic sting again. We really need to get that. Anonymous, as you may know, is the loose-knit hacktivist movement. They embedded a couple of specific calling cards typical of internet trolls. I'm not really sure what those are, not being an internet troll, but I'm sure we'd all recognize them. This is what Texas GOP Chairman Matt Rinaldi said in a statement to the Washington Times, another conservative newspaper, on Saturday. Pro-abortion hackers. Yeah, pro-abortion hackers changed our webpage for a short time before we took it down. We will be increasing security and appreciate the hackers providing us with a fundraising opportunity. Funds we will use to promote even more robust pro-life legislation in Texas. More robust? How could it get any worse? Wow. Side-by-side comparisons of the site from before and after it was compromised made it apparent the hacker or hackers responsible for the defacement made a number of updates and other revisions to its homepage. Probably updated the software, probably improved some things. Giving Texans a voice to promote conservative philosophy and principles was changed to Texas, taking voices from women to promote theocratic erosion of church/state barriers. Oh, come on, that's better. That's more accurate, right?
Not wrong.
No. I don't understand the complaint. Elsewhere on the site, the Texas GOP's mission statement was changed to, "We are committed to taking away all the rights of women so we can live our prosperous Bible-thumping dream." Really? They took offense at that? I mean, tell me what's wrong. Well, tell me what is inaccurate in that statement. I'm sorry, but you should be paying these people because they're obviously updating your site. And whoever hacked the site, and this really threw them for a loop, also embedded a YouTube video for the 1987 song Never Gonna Give You Up by Rick Astley. Also placed an image known as Goatsy prominently on the page. But you just kind of have to do that. And for those of you who don't know, cherish the fact that you don't know what that is. A warning was also added to the bottom of the page. Disclaimer: hackers on steroids are 10 times more effective at romance than 100% of Republicans. Trans demon hackers are coming to get you. Abortion is a choice. I like the trans demon hackers are coming to get you. That's a nice touch. Hackers on steroids is a reference to how Anonymous was described in the media when the shadowy hacktivist group first emerged more than a decade ago. And of course, more recently in February, the CEO of fringe social media service Gab blamed a breach of the platform on mentally ill tranny demon hackers. So that's where the phrase comes from. It was not immediately clear who vandalized the Texas GOP website, which remained offline as of early Saturday afternoon, or if anyone would take credit. Basically, a message on the bottom attributes Anonymous. Look up that word, okay, and you might have an answer to whether or not someone's going to take credit. Seriously, though, Texas is out of control, just basically making it up as they go along, and it's such a dumpster fire at this point that it doesn't matter. The rule of law doesn't matter. The precedent doesn't matter. People don't seem to matter. Here's something else that they did. Texas Governor Greg Abbott, who had COVID only a couple of weeks ago. Is that over, or is he just learning to make peace with that? He has signed a bill regulating how social media companies moderate content. This new law, which passed, I believe, last week, controversially prohibits banning or demonetizing or otherwise restricting content based on the viewpoint of the user or another person, whether or not that viewpoint is expressed on the social media platform itself. Yeah, it also requires social media services to disclose how they promote and moderate content and mandates transparency reports similar to those produced by Facebook, Google, other major web companies. I don't know. I'm curious what your take on this is, Alex, because to say that you are not allowed to kick somebody off of the platform that you own based on what someone believes in or stands for, I mean, we're talking about, you know, we're not talking about minor disagreements here. We're talking about people that are white supremacists. We're talking about fascists. We're talking about the kind of people that we've heard so much about in months and years past, that Twitter and to a degree Facebook has tried to purge. To say that it's not legal to do that, I don't know. Is that something that you think is going to hold up?
This is an interesting question, I think, because historically it's always been answered in the negative, meaning no, it's not going to hold up. Because just about, I think, 14 or 15 years ago was perhaps the first time that this was considered. And almost every single time thereafter, any time that there's been a challenge to the right of a platform to curate or moderate its speech, it's always been the courts have always sided with the platform and its ability to exercise its own discretion. And it's a matter of the First Amendment as well, you know, because these platforms themselves have the First Amendment right to curate and edit the speech that's on their networks. But having said that, you know, we have moved more towards this concept, both on the right and the left, that social media platforms have become part of the public sphere or part of the public space in certain respects. If you recall, a couple of years ago, we had an issue with President Trump banning people from his social media page and that being deemed unconstitutional, because it prevented others who were banned from, from participating in the political process on Twitter. And then on the other side of this, we had Justice Thomas come out very recently, I think within the last 6 or 7 months, in a dissent that was actually throwing out the case as moot that arose to the level of the Supreme Court about President Trump's ability or inability to ban people on social media. And when the court tossed this case out as moot, Justice Thomas went so far as to say, well, hey, look, you know, we're tossing it out as moot, but there's something wrong here, because on the one hand, we are treating this as a private entity's domain to do whatever the hell they want to do. And on the other hand, we're treating social media platforms as integral to the democratic process in the public sphere. And if things enjoy, or even a component of them, enjoy some kind of legal protection that Justice Thomas was suggesting, that social media platforms should be regulated in essence like a telephone company, as some kind of public-private partnership or utility, then discrimination on the basis of viewpoint becomes constitutionally impermissible in that public sphere. In the same way that the government couldn't go out a manual and stop you from getting on your soapbox in Prospect Park and, you know, yelling about something, you know, they couldn't stop you in doing something that was the equivalent public sphere in the digital space. So there's going to be some push and pull in this. I think on the balance, it will be unconstitutional, but there's definitely tension now.
Well, I can't believe I have to explain this to Justice Thomas, but there's so much that we have to explain to him. Okay, so you brought up telephones. Let's use that as a parallel to Twitter. You know, Twitter is an organization that runs the platform. Trump is a user. Okay, so if say I'm an elected official, all right, and I have a phone number, but I don't allow certain people to call me ever. Well, that's not right. That's not right. A phone company is a common carrier. It's different than Twitter. Twitter is not a common carrier. You have to give somebody a phone line, obviously. But I think, you know, looking at the actual Twitter example, Twitter can choose who they want to have on their platform. If somebody is violating the rules, they can kick them off. But if you are on that platform as an elected official, and that is your means of communicating with the populace, it's not a Twitter issue. It's a democracy issue. You can't just only speak to certain people and bar everybody else from having any kind of access. Okay, imagine this. I'm thinking of analogies as I go. imagine you have a meeting room and you hand out keys, but you only hand out keys to the people you like. You're giving a public address, but you're not allowing the public into that room. You're only allowing the people that you've chosen. The building can get sick of this and say, you know what, we don't want you in the building anymore. Get out of here. Play your game somewhere else. But that's got nothing to do with the elected official refusing to allow people to access what he says or she says. I'm sure I can come up with better analogies given some time. But, I mean, to me, it's a pretty clear difference.
Well, also, there's this argument that the people that are espousing this type of prohibition on viewpoint discrimination on social media platforms are the very people that also hold very much libertarian ideals about anti-regulation and the administrative state, and that if the government begins to overregulate things, the country's going to go down the tubes. This is a form of very specific regulation. It's regulation of technology, for sure. But what I see here, Emmanuel, is certainly there's tension here between this notion of...
Uh-oh. Alex is either lost in thought or lost on the internet.
You know, Alex, this is actually a good point. I wanted to just jump in, let you catch your breath.
He's not breathing.
Is he okay?
Well, he's just frozen there. Look at that. Huh. Why don't you say what you were going to say, Kyle, and hopefully Alex will come back to life somehow.
He's trying.
Yeah.
My thought is that in a public official sense, on a private platform, in the case of the former president, he had already been given extra leeway, I think. The pylon effect of private citizens enjoying that and whatever other, maybe people outside the country, bots, who knows, all of that, I think, is distinct mm-hmm. because they were not the public official in the same way. So I think that's important. The private communications, though, I think is it speaks more to the larger tension, because in policing this stuff on the private platforms, it's not actually like taking away the speech. It's moving it to other platforms. Like, you know, hopefully Telegram doesn't break, because a lot of this crap is over there, you know? So that is more of a forgetful network. They probably would say they don't have any eyes on anything that goes on there, right? So we push from these pseudo-public squares to private places, and then those ideas don't actually ever get challenged. They get just reinforced and fester. So I think we're feeling like we have a comfort in pushing for this, but I think there's a danger as well in pushing other in the emergence of workarounds, like platforms that are end-to-end encrypted, platforms that are agnostic of this stuff. You don't then challenge those discussions. And was it pleasant to challenge them when Twitter was overrun with it in the middle of a campaign cycle? No, it was awful. But, I mean, are we fixing it? I think those are all also good questions.
Alex, you're back. I don't know if you know where you got cut off, but let's try again.
I don't know what happened there, but I have no idea where I got cut off. Do you remember? Was anybody paying attention?
We can't quote exactly what you said 5 minutes ago, but you're in the middle of a point. Well,
no, I think the point I was trying to get to was that there certainly is this tension between common carriers in a public space, but I think where we're going to end up here is a space for it that makes sense, in that what's going to matter is not that there's going to be some kind of prohibition on discriminating against Republicans or discriminating against Democrats, but what we should be requiring of our social media platforms is some form of due process that's fundamental in making these determinations themselves. And I don't think that that's too much to expect, and I don't think anybody on the right or the left would disagree with that, because we just should require some kind of deliberative process, some process by which we can determine whether or not it's right to have that viewpoint on there, whether it makes sense, and that there is an opportunity to be heard with respect to that viewpoint. Because I think, as our old friend and a digital libertarian, John Perry Barlow, called them, governments were these, quote, weary giants of flesh and steel, and that were neither competent, able to regulate cyberspace in that sense. And so, there's a lot to reconcile here.
Go ahead, Rob.
It's interesting that we have these two stories together, because in one of them we have, the so-called party of small government, the Republican Party, the Texas Republicans in particular, saying we're going to march into, a privately owned website and decide that they're not allowed to choose what they can or can't have on their own platform. But at the same time, they're going to tell the trans demon hackers that they can't come in and write what they want on their website.
Don't forget what they're telling women in Texas what they can't do. So yeah, there's a lot of overreach here, I believe.
Absolutely.
Okay. To Alex's point, yeah, there should be due process. When you get kicked off of a platform, you should know why. I totally agree with that. And when other things happen, for instance, this just happened to me this morning. Oh my God. I think I complained about Facebook and Google last week, who freaked out because, my Wi-Fi went out and they thought somebody was hacking my account. And well, the same thing happened again with Facebook, where they just, this time there wasn't an outage. They just decided somebody may have had access to your account. I'm like, okay, can you tell me something more? No, change your password. I just changed my password because you told me to do that only a few days ago. What are you doing? What's going on? Do you have any idea how to run your own network? I don't see any evidence of anybody accessing my account. I couldn't really care much less than I already do about Facebook. But, you know, if you think somebody accessed something, at least share with me the information. But no, you get nothing. You just get an accusation that something bad happened and that you have to change a password as a result and go through all these steps when most of us just don't want to be bothered. But if you get booted from a platform because of an algorithm, and I know this happens a lot on Facebook where the algorithm decides that you violated something, that's not acceptable. That's not, you need somebody to tell you this is what happened. This is why you got kicked off. And that's going to have to be a human. I mean, you remember Memphis? Memphis on Twitter, when somebody simply said Memphis and got kicked off of Twitter for 12 hours, I was one of those people. We got an apology in the end because something was wrong with the algorithm where anybody who said Memphis was somehow deemed as violating something. Sometimes, many times, you don't get that. You don't get anything. You don't get the ability to appeal. You don't get the ability to find out why something happened. And this goes for everybody. It's not just one particular viewpoint or anything like that. So that needs to change. That needs to be improved. And I hope we see that soon.
Just it speaks to the layers and layers of theater, sort of UI, user interface theater they've had to layer onto their website just to say we take privacy seriously over and over again for years and decades.
Sure. Yeah, but they're like making up stories and saying, yeah, we're protecting your privacy, and you're not. You're just throwing out random inconveniences to people and claiming it's got something to do with somebody hacking something when there's absolutely no evidence to suggest that. Here's a related story out of Australia. Media companies there can be held responsible for defamatory comments left on their social media pages by members of the public. Yeah, this decision is part of a long-running defamation case that could have huge consequences for the media industry in Australia, forcing news sites to strictly moderate or remove comments on stories shared on Facebook, Twitter, and elsewhere. Anyone who runs a social media page can theoretically be sued over disparaging comments. I don't know how I feel about this, because honestly, if you read news stories on various sites, and you know, I'm gonna name one, Patch.com. You ever read that? It's kind of cool, you know. They have local news on a digital platform, but invariably, there's a whole bunch of racist and white supremacists that will basically take any story and turn it into blaming Mexicans for something. The hate is just unbelievable. We saw the same thing on Newsday years ago. They have pretty much disabled their chat feature because it was abused so much. People say, you know, if you stop making things anonymous, this will go away. That's not true. You see people's real names. They're attaching their real names to the hatred and to the ignorance. And this is not something that we need. It doesn't add anything to the story at all. You know, news stories are written by people known as reporters that are paid, hopefully, for the job. And they do research and they interview people and they write it all out. And to just have some moron come and say something that's completely ignorant and basically takes all the attention away from the work that you've put in, I don't understand why anybody wants to do that on their platform. Exception, the New York Times. The New York Times, I think, has people that actually moderate and go through and only allow the intelligent or semi-intelligent comments to be posted. And yeah, I know people will claim, oh my God, that's censorship. No, that's editing. that's making something good and not just having, you know, what I call the Usenet effect. Remember Usenet? Basically, it was way back in the 90s where there were news groups on the internet and they were completely unmoderated except for the ones that were. And people just posted all kinds of garbage. It was awful. It was filled with spam, filled with hatred. And I don't think anybody uses it anymore. Why would they? Why would anybody want that? Same thing here. So I'm not sure how I feel about this ruling, holding companies liable, but I am in favor of things that get rid of all these damn chat boards or just reduce them to something manageable where the lowest common denominator doesn't always prevail.
Yeah, I think you're on the right track here too, Emmanuel. But then again, I think there's also the exception of the egregious case here. You know, let's say, for example, prominently displayed in the comments of a major media outlet or a major Facebook, are the personal details, including the home address and contact information for a minor. And the publisher is aware of this, and you can prove that the publisher was aware of it and had the power but refused to take it down. I think in these types of egregious or grossly negligent mm-hmm. situations, some kind of liability for turning a blind eye to it would make sense. But the power to abuse this type of general law, perhaps this should be the exception to the law and not the law itself, is really what I'm arguing here. But I think if you were to place this burden on anybody who runs, let's say, a Facebook page for an association or, a movie or a fan club, something like that, you can't possibly be tasked with moderating all of those comments. It becomes a compliance burden. It would probably spark a cottage industry for comment compliance that would lead to over-censorship based on keywords. And again, we'll be back to the problem that we had starting in the 90s where we are over-blocking material that we don't want to block and under-blocking material that we do want to block. So, in that sense, I could see this type of rule.
I think there's a difference, though, between an individual, running a Facebook timeline and a company or a newspaper. And I think, it's not too much to expect. Say you're a newspaper, media outlet, one sort or another. You hold your writers to a particular standard. You don't just print anything. It goes through the editing process, fact checking, that sort of thing. Well, why not view the people who are writing comments as kind of a form of writer? You're not paying them. They're not really subcontractors, but they are people that are contributing to the overall publication. Just like someone who writes a letter to the editor. You don't just print anything. You print something that is basically factual, an opinion, and doesn't violate your standards. Why can't the same apply to people who are posting comments? It takes a little bit of time to basically say, is this good? Okay, we'll print this. Is this bad? Then we won't print it. I think that simple act on the part of a media company would get rid of a lot of the unpleasantness and ignorance and just raise the standards a bit.
Oh, I agree. And just to bounce in, I think that's actually what the Financial Times does. And I think you actually have to be a subscriber to the Financial Times in order to comment on their pieces, which is interesting. So I've written several articles for them now, and when I was a non-subscriber, I couldn't even comment in my own article or respond to the other comments. But all of the comments were substantively acceptable and pretty well formulated. So I think there is that type of moderation happening.
Go ahead, Rob.
A really important part of this story is that it's not even about the comments on a newspaper's own site. This is about social media comments. This is somebody suing news outlets because people left comments on their Facebook pages where they shared the stories. And so this isn't even about coming in and policing like, okay, you could see holding an organization liable if somebody says something truly terrible on their web property, as it were, but this is their Facebook account. I mean, can you imagine being like responsible for things that happen on, like, say, WBAI's Facebook presence in the comments section, or things like that? It's crazy because we know what a cesspool it is in the Facebook comments for anything, also we don't own Facebook. We don't run it. That is not a machine to which we have access. But now Australia would expect us to police that.
Yeah, I don't use Facebook, so I don't really know how it all comes together. But if you're a presence on Facebook, do you not have control over what people say in your group?
I don't even know because I don't use Facebook either. But like
we
social
need somebody
media
to
in
use
general,
Facebook, yes.
We have a Twitter account for this program. It's Hacker Radio Show, and you know we enjoy hearing from listeners, communicating with them that way. But if somebody replies to something we post and says something crappy, you know it should not be our responsibility to like somehow affect the situation, somehow change that, because we are not Twitter.
Right. Well, we could talk about this for a very long time, and obviously we need to know more about these social platforms. But, you know, I think we all are in need of raising the bar a little bit.
Yeah, I'm just hearing it's either proactive or retroactive, and I think there is a benefit to stemming that. Then you don't really have to get into liability issues, but, you know.
Before we sign off tonight, and again, 212-209-2950, that's the number to call to pledge support for this radio station. Become a BAI buddy, pledge a minimal amount every month, and you'll be supporting this place and really making a big difference. 212-209-2950 or the website give2wbai.org. Here's an interesting story. We just had the anniversary of 9/11 go by on Saturday. But get this, Adobe ending support for Flash, its once ubiquitous multimedia content player. Remember that? Last year, that's when they stopped supporting it. It meant that some of the news coverage of the September 11th attacks and other major events from the early days of online journalism are no longer accessible. For example, the Washington Post and ABC News both have broken experiences within their September 11th coverage, viewable in the Internet Archive, thanks to our friends over there and Jason Scott. CNN's online coverage of September 11th also has been impacted by the end of Flash. That means it was once an interactive explainer of how the planes hit the World Trade Center, a visually rich story on where some survivors of the attacks are now, at best, a non-functioning still image or, at worst, a gray box, informing readers that Adobe Flash Player is no longer supported. This is the danger of digitization without maintenance. And, you know, we always say to ourselves that once something's on the Internet, it's there forever. It couldn't be less true, because things disappear. Things get outdated. You know, new versions come out and software becomes incompatible. And before you know it, you've lost something that you thought was going to be there and are surprised when it's not there. Whereas, you know, the old analog things, they just remain. They're always there. Your vinyl, your pictures, you know, your books. We need a way to ensure that the things that we digitize are kept in the archive. And thank God Internet Archive exists to do exactly this. But we need to do more as both users, developers, companies. This kind of thing happens way too often.
And if you take an interest in this, and you've never experienced old formats or something like that, learn about them. Because these things are happening at an increasing rate. There's so much change all the time. There will be people needed to emulate this stuff or to figure out ways around these kinds of retirement or changes in format. So it's really sad, because they're establishing something that's for creatives and forever. They rely on them because that's the kind of tools creatives are using, and you just eliminate all of this content in the process without really realizing the consequence.
We are out of time. OTH@2600.com is our email address. We're going to overtime. YouTube.com/channel2600. Here's a song from somebody you might have heard of before, Lou Reed. You heard of Lou Reed, right? But I'll bet you never heard this song. Good night.
I was sleeping, gently napping, when I heard the phone. Who is on the other end talking? Am I even home? Did you see what she did to him? Did you hear what they said? Just a New York conversation rattling in my head. Oh my, and what shall we wear? Oh my, and who really cares? Just a New York conversation, gossip all of the time. Did you hear who did what to whom? Happens all the time. Who has touched and who has dabbled here in the city of shows? Openings, closings, bed repartee, everybody knows.
Oh, how sad, and why do we call? Oh, I'm glad to hear from you all. I am calling, yes, I'm calling just to speak to you. For I know this night will kill me if I can't be with you. If I can't be with you.
Our 2021 election is getting underway. Listener democracy keeps our station connected to the people and accountable to you and listeners just like you. Look for your ballot in your email box from Simply Voting or a bright blue postcard. If you need a replacement ballot, visit elections.pacifica.org and file a ballot request form. Call 510-993-0320 if you need a paper ballot.
This is the professor, Dr. Ron Daniels. The Institute of the Black World 21st Century's Black Family Summit proudly announces the Community Cares Listening Line for Black first responders and essential workers. We're here and we're listening. The Community Cares Listening Line is a free, confidential service staffed with responsive volunteers who can provide emotional support and share information with our callers. If you're feeling anxious, afraid, distressed, burdened, or overwhelmed by a range of emotions, please call the Community Cares Listening Line at 877-719-1117. That's 877-719-1117.
Dear WBAI listener, we can certainly use a little help from our friends. After years of falling behind under new management, Pacifica has now gotten its financial papers in order and can apply once again for grants. That means WBAI, which is owned by the nonprofit Pacifica Foundation, can also apply for funding. And we are looking for a pro bono grant writer to help our 61-year-old station by writing grants for us. If you have time, expertise, and interest, please contact Bertol, our station manager, at bertol@wbai.org. You'd be helping to ensure the stability and growth of this historic listener-sponsored radio station. With details, please email bertol@wbai.org. That's B-E-R-T-H-O-L-D, bertol@wbai.org, with Grant Ryder in the subject heading. Many thanks. Many, many thanks. This is listener-sponsored WBAI New York.
Mother Earth is occupied by the United States of Amazon. Call it surveillance capitalism. Sunday, September 19th, in New York City, come together for peaceful conversation on how to create a better tomorrow. Connect the dots. From Assange to Mumia, COVID and climate, housing and policing, from Afghanistan to Yemen, we're building coalitions. Black Lives Matter and Code Pink to Extinction Rebellion and Veterans for Peace, WBAI, Pacifica Radio, and more. Join us. Sunday, September 19th, 11 a.m. to 5 p.m. in Foley Square. I'm Zul, and I'm a whistleblower for justice, people, and planet. RisingTogether.info for more information.
This is WBAI New York, 99.5 FM, and WBAI.org online. Stay tuned for Exploration with Michio Kaku. Coming up.
Welcome. This is Dr. Michio Kaku, Professor of Theoretical Physics at the City College and the Graduate Center of the City University of New York, and this is Exploration. Every week on Exploration, we discuss the fascinating world of science and its impact on society. And today, leading off, we're going to summarize some of the top stories of the past week. Our lead story today concerns the worldwide commemoration of 9/11. It's hard to believe that it's been 20 years since the World Trade Center was attacked, initiating a whole new phase in world history. And the question is, well, yes, the United States can always win wars. I learned that when I was in the United States Infantry at the height of the Vietnam War. We have the firepower. We have the industrial complex. The United States can always win wars. But the question is, can we win the peace? In other words, can we win the hearts and minds of the people of the Middle East so we don't have to repeat this all over again and spend trillions of dollars trying to impose our will? And then I'd like to say a few things about the coronavirus, the good news and the bad news. The good news is we are approaching herd immunity in certain sectors of the world as we approach near 70% vaccination rate. We're not there yet, but we're getting close. However, the bad news is it turns out that the risk of dying from the virus is 11 times greater if you are unvaccinated versus people who are vaccinated. That's right. You are 11 times more likely to die if you are unvaccinated. And then I'd like to say a few things about, well, the weather. Look at what's happening to California and the West. Even a tourist area, southern Lake Tahoe, is being engulfed in flames, fires out of control. And take a look at Hurricane Ida, which ripped right through the New York, New Jersey metropolitan area, creating havoc. Is this the new normal? That is, droughts which create gigantic firestorms. Simultaneously, we have inundation with floods with massive hurricanes. Is this the sign of global warming? Well, we'll say a few things about that, the pros and cons of that. And then I'd like to say a few things about, well, your health. We all know that sugar is bad for you, but precisely how bad is it for you? Well, the latest numbers have come in. 100,000 people have been analyzed, and we now realize that the cost of too much sugar in your diet is overwhelming. If you cut 20% of sugar from packaged foods in your diet, cut 40% of soda, you can prevent 2.5 million cardiovascular diseases, the leading cause of death in the United States. Well, let's just jump right into some of the top stories the past week. The United States is now looking back at 20 years on the war on terror. Have we won that war? Are we safer now, 20 years after 9/11? Let me just say a few things that my apartment house was, well, right next to 9/11. When 9/11 happened, I could not go home. It turns out that all traffic below Canal Street in Manhattan was sealed off. The whole area was basically cut off from the rest of the world. I could not go home for weeks. I had to stay in friends' house. Finally, I was able to get access to my apartment after a few weeks, and I talked to one of the neighbors, and he said that just as 9/11 was emerging, he looked and saw the buildings, the World Trade Centers, burning out of control, and then he saw something that he will never forget. He'll never forget the sight of people jumping off the World Trade Center to a certain death. People jumping off, hurling tens of floors as they were hovering above the streets of Manhattan. On one hand, behind them were flames, the chaos of the devastation of 9/11, certain death if they stayed there. And the other possibility was to, well, jump off the building, hurl yourself tens of floors above the surface of Manhattan, and hope and pray that you may land on something soft. It was a sight that he would never forget. Well, I'll never forget the fact that I was in the military from 1968 to 1970, at the height of the Vietnam War. I was in the United States Infantry. And we had a demonstration of firepower. We had one demonstration I'll never forget in Fort Benning, Georgia, of what we can unleash on the battlefield. We can unleash napalm, white phosphorus, grenades, machine gun fire, incredible, incredible firepower on a peasant nation. And yet, it was clear to all of us watching this demonstration that in spite of all the might that we had, we were losing the war. And my fellow GIs would say to me, you know, America, we always win. We can never fail. We have overwhelming firepower. We can win the war. The question is, can we win the peace? And I said to myself, we are losing the peace. We're not winning over the hearts and minds of the Vietnamese people. Well, ask yourself this question. After 20 years of spending trillions of dollars of resources by amassing firepower on a scale that we've never seen before, are you safer now than you were 20 years ago? In other words, yes, we can win the war, but can we win the peace? Have we won over the hearts and minds of the people of the Middle East? Think about that. Because winning the war on terror is not just matching the terrorists bullet for bullet, bomb for bomb, helicopter for helicopter. No, it's winning over the hearts and minds of the people. That's the key. So ask yourself a question. After spending trillions of dollars and shedding our blood, are you safer now because we've won over the hearts and minds of the people of the Middle East? Well, it's something to think about after 20 years. Well, let's say a few things about the Delta virus, which is ravaging some areas, but there's also a shred of good news, too. Certain nations, smaller nations, are approaching 70% vaccination rate of adults. That's good news because once you start to hit numbers like that, we're at the light at the end of the tunnel because we're headed toward herd immunity. Herd immunity does not mean that you're 100% vaccinated. It just means that so many people are vaccinated or immune that the virus cannot spread easily and therefore is stopped in its tracks. However, the danger is, what about the 30 to 50% of the people who are not vaccinated? They are a reservoir of mutants. And that's where the Delta virus comes in. The Delta virus is many times more infectious than the previous Alpha version, which in turn is more infectious than the original virus. In fact, 90%, just in a few weeks, 90% of all the infections in the United States are due to this new strain, the Delta virus. It turns out the Delta virus is more infectious than the previous version, but it's not necessarily more lethal in terms of the people it kills. However, the bad news. The latest figures show that when you compare 100,000 people, you compare the people who are vaccinated to the people who are unvaccinated, you are at 5 times greater risk of infection if you are unvaccinated. 5 times greater risk. You are 30 times facing a 30 times greater risk of hospitalization if you are unvaccinated. And here's the killer. You are 11 times more likely to die of the virus if you are unvaccinated versus the vaccinated. Now, you ask yourself a simple question. Why is it that so many people don't want to get vaccinated? Well, many personal reasons. But among them, people feel that there are side effects. Yes, there are side effects. There are side effects to just walking out in the street. There are side effects to anything. But compare the side effects to vaccination, which are extremely tiny, versus the side effect of being unvaccinated, which is death. Think about that. Of course, not everyone is going to die because you're infected, but the chances of dying are 11 times greater if you are unvaccinated versus those people who are vaccinated. Now, in other words, for people who don't want to be vaccinated, you're endangering not just yourself, you're endangering your loved ones. You're endangering the people around you because you can spread the virus. So, yeah, you have the right to commit suicide in that sense. It's a free country. But do you have the right to infect your own relatives, the people closest to you, knowing that in some sense it could be a death warrant for them? Well, think about that, because it's not just a question of, well, it's my right to not be vaccinated. It's a question that you're spreading the disease and you're preventing us from reaching herd immunity.